This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, January 20th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. For all his concerns about leaving a loaded weapon in the White House for its next inhabitant, President Obama's last day leaves behind an enhanced executive branch, at least in terms of its assumed powers. Gene Healy, Vice President at the Cato Institute, comments.
What is the best thing about the Obama presidency that you can think of?
Well, I think the president did tamp down some of the rhetoric, the crisis rhetoric surrounding the war on terrorism. He didn't do anything to tamp down the level of military activity or the level of surveillance or other policies associated with the war on terror, but I think there was a positive change in playing down this atmosphere of permanent crisis. And outside of the policy realm, I think you can say that in his public conduct, Barack Obama was generally a model of class and dignity, and by way of contrast with the incoming president, that contrast may be become sharper and sharper. There's the great political scientist Theodore Lowy coined an axiom that says that every president contributes to the upgrading of the reputation of his predecessor. I see no reason to think that Lowy's law is going to isn't going to operate going forward.
Now, when Barack Obama became president, he ran against the bad war, which was Iraq, and said things about how we need to commit to the good war, which was Afghanistan. And if you look at the data coming back from 2016, the Obama administration dropped 26,000 and change bombs in 7 countries on the planet.
Yeah, it's amazing that Obama retains this reputation as a reluctant warrior, given the record and given the level of military activity. 26,000 bombs over 7 countries over Labor Day weekend, just earlier this summer, we dropped he launched a total of something like 70 airstrikes over 6 countries just over Labor Day weekend. Presidential war, ongoing military activity across a broad range of countries has become so normalized in this administration that, you know, most of us barely looked up from the grill when we were bombing 6 countries over Labor Day weekend.
In your long piece at Reason, Goodbye Obama, you talk about the idea that congressional gridlock had been construed as a ceding power from Congress to the executive branch.
The slogan in the run-up to his reelection for a series of executive orders and other unilateral directives was, "We can't wait." And what that meant was, we can't wait for Congress to pass laws before the executive branch acts. And you saw in that flurry of executive branch initiatives, things like the Homeland Security Directive that eventually expanded to give legal status to roughly half of the undocumented immigrants in the country. That's a policy that as a public policy matter that most of us at Cato agree with. These were not the sorts of people that you would want to prioritize in any sort of immigration enforcement. However, it was, you know, done with the stroke of a pen in the run-up to an impending election. It looked an awful lot like the president on his own with the stroke of a pen passing laws. And I think we're, you know, turnabout is fair play, and we're going to see a lot of unilateral activity in the other direction from the Trump administration, as Trump put it on the campaign trail. you know, I'm not going to, he said, I'm not going to refuse executive orders. Obama's led the way, to be honest with you.
How do you think Barack Obama's presidency, specifically with regard to taking action when Congress refuses to act, contributed to Donald Trump becoming president?
Well, I don't know if, you know, everyone likes to think that the issues that they focus on form the basis of whatever political result you know, we all like to think that the voters are particularly interested in our issues. I don't know that Donald Trump, you know, rose to power and won the election on the strength of disgust with Obama's increasingly imperial presidency. It would seem like a strange solution to that problem, given the fact that Donald Trump doesn't have any problem with imperious behavior by a chief executive and intends to rule by decree to, you know, to the same extent or more that Obama has. So I don't know if it played a role. The issues surrounding the use of executive power and the separation of powers really should play more of a role in our public debate. For a couple of election cycles before this, the reporter Charlie Savage with the New York Times issued questionnaires to major party candidates on their views of the scope of executive power. And this is a really useful document to have. It came up a lot in Obama's first term when he unilaterally launched a 7-month regime change bombing campaign in Libya, something that he said the president had no power to do in this questionnaire. But when Charlie Savage tried to get the candidates to answer this questionnaire during this election cycle, Trump didn't answer it, Hillary Clinton didn't answer it, and it just sort of died on the vine. So in an election when issues of the scope of the president's power should have been front and center, it really did not play as much of a role in the public debate as it deserved to.
When you and I have talked in the past, and I think you go into this at some length in your book, just because the public doesn't trust government, or just because trust in government is very low, doesn't mean they're not going to ask government to do a lot. So even if the broad public doesn't really understand a lot of the policies that Barack Obama imposed, and they don't trust him, it doesn't mean that they're not going to then ask or elect someone who is potentially more bothersome.
Yeah, there's sort of a schizophrenia or a bipolarity in the public mind. Trust in government numbers have, after Vietnam and Watergate, plummeted. How much do you trust the federal government in Washington to do what is right? Most of the time, always, sometimes, never. This is a question that Gallup and others have been asking for more than 50 years. So there's a long range of survey data on it. And trust in government bottomed out in the United States after Watergate and never recovered its pre-Watergate, pre-Vietnam levels. There was an uptick right after September 11th, but trust in government has remained historically low. At the same time, though, the fact that that people don't trust the government in Washington to do what is right, as you point out, doesn't lead them to ask less of it. The president, in particular, is viewed as someone who's responsible for everything from the price of gas to the state of the national soul. You would think that a skeptical view of government's competence and good faith would lead people to ask less of it, but that's people have not quite made that connection yet.
President Obama, as we approached his last week in office, decided to, as I read on Twitter, give the middle finger to Cubans. Refugees. He also
expanded the degree to which the NSA can share data without vetting that information and go ahead and share that information with other intelligence agencies. And yet there is this concerted group of people asking about whether or not the president will pardon Edward Snowden.
Well, yeah, I think that's unlikely, but we'll see. Obama has in the past expressed reservations privately with advisors and sometimes publicly in speeches about the growth of executive power under his presidency. In private, he's worried to advisors about whether he's, quote, leaving a loaded weapon behind in the Oval Office for the next president. And yet on the way out the door, he's expanded executive powers that Trump will inherit in several different ways. Expansion of federal agencies' access to raw intelligence data that includes the contents of Americans' personal communications. That's something that just last week the president expanded to. The Drug Enforcement Administration and the Department of Homeland Security, among others, can get access to raw signals intelligence collected overseas without the privacy protections and minimization procedures that are supposed to happen before any of that data is shared. He also, after the election, has even expanded the scope of the war on terror. He added to the list of jihadist groups that we target under the 2001 authorization for the use of military force. He added Somalia's al-Shabaab to that. So he's opening new fronts in the what's been called the forever war, even as he's preparing to exit and hand this loaded weapon over to Donald Trump. And I think this really needs to be, as I point out in the Reason article, I think this really needs to be seen as the central fact of Obama's legacy. He inherited an already too powerful presidency from George W. Bush. He proceeded to expand the powers of that office greatly, in some ways a much bigger expansion than had been carried out under Bush and Cheney. And now he pays that forward to Donald Trump. So I think when we're thinking about Obama's legacy, when we're thinking about how he will be viewed by history, history rarely gets it right. But if it did, I think an important part of the Obama story, if not the central part, is his empowerment of Donald Trump.
Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate this podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.